an ending ever. The sweet mystery of life. La da da dee. La da dee 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 dee. The sweet mystery of life, unending ever. La da dee 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 dee. La da 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 tu da tu da tu da tu da tu. La da da dee 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 dee. La da tu. Speaking of mysteries, we have a titillating announcement to make here. How long has it been since you've been titillated? Sounds bad, doesn't it? It comes with fringe on it, you know. But we have a titillating announcement here to make, and it is, forsooth and to wit, the following, that very shortly, in fact, next Monday, we will announce the winner in our head-crushing equation contest. You remember a couple of... Well, it's almost been a month or so. It's been more than a month, hasn't it? Something like that, way back. We requested gigantic blockbuster equations in which the only requirement has to be, one, that they're workable. They really are real equations, you know, algebra-type equations. And two, C has to equal 3. And the total equation comes out in equals 0. And we have a winner. It was submitted by a guy who's going to be probably surprised he was a winner. Because the way he approached that equation, I suspect he's never won anything in his life. You can tell a lot about that. You know, it's like a Rorschach test. But it'll be next Monday we will declare the winner. And then, of course, all the excitement will be over. Ah, sweet mystery of life. Unending ever. I'll tell you, you know, I'm beginning to believe that there is, if you don't mind if I get a little philosophical here on a Friday night. Hey, you know, speaking of Friday night, you realize that this is for a gigantic proportion of the sporting public. This is a very, very significant night. The night before the Indy. And you don't mind if I indulge myself and do a thing about the Indianapolis race. I noticed most people in the East couldn't care less. Indianapolis race means nothing. And yet, around the world, there are only two or three sporting events, I'm talking about on a worldwide basis, elicits more press, more worldwide interest, than the Indianapolis Speedway 500-mile classic. And it is one of the truly legendary sporting events that takes place in America. It has to be compared. If you're going to compare Indy with anything else, forget racing. We're not even talking about racing particularly. The only thing that you could really compare Indy with would be, say, the Grand National, which is a famous derby, the Derby, you know. The Derby, you could compare. I'm talking about on a worldwide basis. What else? Let's see. That would be almost it. That elicits worldwide interest. The only possible exception would be when they have the great yacht races that elicits. This gets worldwide attention. You know, when the Lipton Cup or the America Cup is being contested for. I don't know why I called it the Lipton. Lipton is the guy that tried. You know who he is? He's one of the great tragic, non-successful characters in all the history of sport. Did you ever hear of his fantastic, endless, non-successful quest? You know who Lipton was, don't you? Well, you've heard of Lipton tea, haven't you? Well, just take a look at the tea box, and there you'll see him right there on his side. And he's wearing this little funny cap. To Sir Thomas Lipton, right? Well, Sir Thomas Lipton spent endless years trying to win the America Cup, and he turned out a succession of yachts that came over here to fight for this trophy. Never won it. Never won it. Never even came close, which is really tragic. And he was such a cuckoo for yachts that when he, you know, had his picture put on the Lipton tea thing, that's very important. Not every guy gets his picture put on put on the brand name of something. He had this funny little hat, which is his yachting cap. That's what he really was interested in. He didn't have a tea picker's cap. He had a yachter, a cap of a yachter. And I think that probably is about the only sporting event that gets any worldwide attention. Now, for those of you who have never been to it, anything you've ever seen in the movies or anything you've ever seen in newsreels or on TV, any films of this race, can't conceivably come close to the curious ambience and the feeling that is around the race right now, this minute, tonight. And in fact, they're going to begin tomorrow at 12. That's when the race begins. You know what the great worry is right now around, I just checked with the official types in our sporting department here, and they're sitting back there rattling the bones, you know, and yelling and playing. But yeah, all sporting departments are alike. And, you notice I don't say sports department, it's a sporting department we have here. They're sitting back there, you know, playing blackjack and making sneaky phone calls. Oh, yeah, they're always on the phone. But they are, always, every place I've ever worked, always on the phone. There's always some guy named Doug who's sitting back on the phone, holding the phone so that you can't hear who he's talking to. That's always the way it is. So, nevertheless, at this moment, right at this instant, at this time of night, there is a growing, curious tension around the track at Indianapolis. Now, for those of you who've never been there, one of the main differences, of course, between this race and any other race is the fantastic machines that take part in it. That the Indianapolis racer is really just designed for that race. It doesn't run much in anything else. It's designed to make that left-hand turn. It just makes a left-hand turn. It's designed like some lethal piece of machinery for one specific purpose, and only one. Now, you go to any of the other major races around the world, you take the Formula One cars, the great cars that run at Le Mans and Monaco and so on, these cars are a very different breed of cat. You couldn't take any of those cars and put it in Indianapolis and have it last more than a couple of hundred miles. These cars are something else. And if you've watched, have you watched the fantastic speeds they've been turning up in the last couple of weeks in practice runs, qualification runs? Now, when you hear of a car that turns a practice run at 195 or 191, do you have any idea what kind of speeds he's reaching on the straight? You've got to realize he makes four turns in that race. You know, that the actual Indianapolis Speedway track is, it's a 2.5 miles, roughly. 2.25 miles. That's the total run from start line all the way around to start line. It's a 2.5 mile oval. And it's really not an oval yet. It's almost like a big, if you were to look down on a rectangle, like a box, and the corners are rounded off. It's got four big corners. Now, the part that's inside is naturally called the infield. And this is where all the action, much of the action, occurs. It has a great grandstand that runs along one straight. And in the middle of that grandstand, of course, is this huge tower that sticks up, which is the scoring tower. Have you seen pictures of that thing? It stands up in the air like an enormous, just a straight tower. It sticks up, and it's got all these numbers all over it. And each car has got a number, naturally, from 1 to 33. And, the cars have all different numbers, but the one that has the number 1, any car that runs number 1 is the car that won the race the year before. So the number 1 car will be out there. And that's all the other numbers. There are various numbers that have to do with the guy's personal number and the number he wound up in the national ratings the year before and all that. So these numbers are not just arbitrary, see. So you'll see these numbers flashing up and down on the boards. And this board stands high, and you can tell right at the top, you'll see whatever car is leading. And that number stands right up at the top. So at a glance, you can tell the rotation of all the various cars, well, how they're doing in the race. And so naturally, the pole car, you know what the pole car is. For those of you who don't know what the designations of these cars are, the pole car is the car that qualified with the fastest qualifying speed during the qualification runs. On a certain specific set of days, not just overall, certain specific days. Now, that he is sitting in the pole, which means that he's on the number one row next to the infield. He's right on the pole. There he is, see. And that's a tough place to beat. The one, when that guy starts out, of course, he takes the first lap almost invariably. And you know what lap money is? You are what lap money is. Well, lap money is the amount of money that a driver makes on the number of laps he leads the race. So a guy can lead the race for, say, 100 laps and still not win. Something could happen. He could wreck his differential or his transmission goes out, and that's the end of it. Maybe he just loses. Somebody finally gets him on one of the turns, and he winds up in fourth or fifth. Now, he gets, I think it's $200 every lap that he's leading the race. His car earns that much in lap money. And so right from the very shot out of the gun, you know, when the first roar of the engines go, they roar down that straight, that guy is already, they go around once. He's already earned $200 right from the start. And that's nothing, of course, compared to what it costs to run a car in these races. Do you know what it costs to run a car? What they feel today that it costs just to put a car in that race, to get the driver, to run the thing, and to prepare it with the mechanics and all that. It costs just under today. And I'm talking about a car that's just a conventional contestant in the race, not anything special. Around $200,000, just a little bit less than that now. Around $195,000. I figured that if you really want to, you know, play it really chintzy, you know, get a 10th-rate driver and go down at the Shell station to get some mechanic to put the thing on the track for you, you know, you may be able to squeak by at $100,500, which is $150,000. Of course, you've got no chance with a car like that, but you'd at least always tell your friends that you had a car in Indy, see, even if it only went the first quarter lap, you know, and went through the Carvel ice cream stand, and that was the end of it. But nevertheless, this is a fantastic event, you see. And all over the world, these drivers come just to watch. Now, that race has far more prestige among the people who are really knowledgeable about cars than it has among the sports writers, curiously enough. This is WOR New York, and let's get on with some of these commercials here. We've got a thing for Memorial Day. Huffman Coors has begun their big Memorial Day sale. So you'll be able to get in on Huffman Coors' famous Memorial Day furniture bargains before Memorial Day. So they got fantastic bargains. And what bargains? You'll be able to buy luxury famous make mattresses or box springs, twin or full size, for only $55 each. There's a luxury rosewood and champagne velvet sofa going for only $299. That'll teach you. You may buy mill trials of nationally advertised pile carpeting for $10.95 a square yard. And Huffman Coors is having a gigantic Memorial Day sale. It's being held at every one of Huffman Coors' 13 fine furniture stores in New Jersey and in Nanuet, New York. Is that Nanuet or Nanuet? Nanuet? Don't know it. Open every day from 9:30 to 9:30, Saturday until 6. You can call area code 201-343-4300 for the location of the nearest Huffman Coors Memorial Day sale. It's a big deal. Let's see. We've got something for Newsday, do we? All right, hit it. Hit it.
Hooray for Newsday. Glad
the sports
section?
Yeah. Here it is.
Hey, Jack, here's the sports section.
Oh, nuts.
What's the matter?
They don't have the final score of the Mets game.
Frustrating, isn't it? Believe me, I know. I'm Marty O'Shea, sports news editor of Newsday. Until recently, fans on Long Island frequently didn't get the final scores of Saturday night games in the New York Sunday papers. But now Long Island has its own Sunday paper, Sunday Newsday. Newsday isn't trucked out from the city. That means we can give you the latest sports news available on the island. We've doubled the size of the Sunday sports section, so you'll get more news. And since we don't have to cover Westchester, Connecticut, and New Jersey, you'll get more news about Long Island school sports. So keep up with the Mets and Jets and Nets in Sunday Newsday. We can't guarantee you'll like the final score, but at least you'll know it. Sunday Newsday. We're glad you like it.
Okay. All right, that's fair enough. I like that little sterling home life drama there.
Hey, Jerry, do we have the information here on Fritz the Cat? I mean, I have the book here, but I mean, do you have where it's playing and all that stuff? Are you? It's playing all over? Fritz the Cat is playing all over? Well. And they talked about Rome. Well. all I can say, friends, is Fritz the Cat is playing all over. And if you haven't seen Fritz the Cat, I would suggest you do so. That's not a personal recommendation. I would say that if you got that kind of mind, I would suggest you see it. It's a blockbuster in many ways. It's a turning point. It's an X-rated cartoon, if you really want to know what it is. And, of course, many of you know what X-rated cartoons. Many of you used to have those little blue books you carry around. You know, those were X-rated right from the start. But Fritz the Cat is playing everywhere. And I know a couple of the guys who are involved in this thing. Steve Krantz, for example, used to be over at WNEW. He produced it. Steve Krantz. Did you know that? Bob Crumb is the cartoonist that the thing is based upon. He didn't do the animation or anything. They just based it on his character, Fritz. Fritz, the lascivious cat. And if you'd like to see Fritz the Cat, well, you could do so at your own risk. But I'm just reminding you, it's playing all over the place. Let's see, we have a general tire. Well, let me hear those bugles, please. Yes, it's a great second tire half-off sale on General Tire's best four-ply nylon cord tires. Here's the story. You buy one General Jet Air 3 at the regular low-selling price and get the second tire for just half price. That's a pretty good deal. Plus $175 for the tax, you know, depending on the size. You save from $12.75 to $24.25 on that second tire at this big sale. So save now during the great second tire half-off sale. Hurry, the sale ends Saturday, May 27th. Home of the big red General Tire G at your one-stop car care headquarters. Hooray! Yeah. Big red G. Hey, we did it. That sale ends tomorrow, according to this note. Now, let's see. We've got one more. Let's see. We've done this. Yeah. We've got the zip kit thing here. And if you have any skin problems, we have a note here about Dermacon Skin Cleanser. It's the zip kit. The kit that contains three different types of skin medications. One, they have the Dermacon Skin Cleanser, which cleans your skin. The Dermacon Medicated Lotion for the daytime. You put this stuff on, and it helps your problems, like whiteheads and stuff. And Dermacon Medicated Cream for nighttime. It heals and soothes while you sleep. Sounds like fun. And you can get this Dermacon kit. It's called the Dermacon Zip Kit. Give it a 30-day trial, and you'll see the difference. So you can buy Dermacon Zip Kit at Genovese, Wayland, Mac, Drug Guild, and other leading pharmacies. That's Dermacon Zip Kit. All right. Hooray. There, we've got all the commercials done. You know, I'll tell you, I was at the Indy race last year. I covered it for Car and Driver. For those of you who are not aware of it, I'll just drop this for what it's worth, that I do a monthly column for Car and Driver. Have you ever read it, the column at all, in the C&D? Oh, you don't read that magazine anyway. You're strictly Reader's Digest, right? No? But nevertheless, I covered the race from a very privileged standpoint. It's kind of great to go to a thing like the Indianapolis 500 and see the fantastic tradition and the curious mystique that goes on much beyond and behind the race. It has very little to do with the race. For example, I'll tell you something I've never encountered in at all in print. And this was the first time that I'd ever covered the race as a journalist, so I had all the official journalist badges, and they come in about 15 different grades, you know. Or didn't you know that? That you don't just get a pass to the race when you're a journalist. You get all, it ranges all the way from what they call a pit pass, which means you can go right down into the pits, right in the middle of the race, to a fairly low-level pass, which means you just get in free, you know, someplace. You can stand somewhere and watch the race. And they come in all different colors, and they're very heavily policed because, naturally, this is pretty dangerous, and they can't just let anybody come down in that pit down there when the race is on because, boy, there's a lot of action happens down there, ranging all the way from an occasional car that blows up right in the pit to somebody getting nicked by a tire, which has happened quite often in the pits down there. Well, I happen to have one of the top, due to the fact that I was doing a piece on it, I had one of the top infield pit passes. So I was involved in all the various stuff that they have. And before the race, and like today, here during Friday and Saturday morning before the race, there's about 1,000 cocktail parties that are held all over around the track in various places. They may hold them in the Howard Johnson. They hold them in the Holiday Inn. They hold them in the hotel, all different places. And who holds these things? Well, all kinds of manufacturers of one kind or another who have stuff running in the race. STP will have a cocktail party. Somebody will have a Goodyear Firestone. Somebody who builds tires. Somebody who builds special lubrications. Yeah, Shell have a cocktail party. And of course, you go to all these various things, and they have all kinds of elegant things that are going on. They give you little souvenirs, all kinds of stuff. But the thing is that all the world's press is there. This is something you probably are not too aware of, because TV never talks about this. TV's only interested in TV. But the world's press is there. I mean, from very elegant automotive magazines that are done in places like Perth, Australia, Bombay, and the places like, you know, London, of course. England is a great racing country, so there's all kinds of English writers that always show up, very elegant correspondents in their tweed suits, and they always have their birds with them, you know, and and the champagne flows like water, and all these various writers, they all know each other. It's a very closed circuit. The circuit of the journalist celebrity in the racing world has a very special quality to it, and the Sterling Moss is always on hand, and all the various celebrities that are connected with the racing world all show up about 3 or 4 days before the Indianapolis race, and they begin to see each other, and they sit by the pool in the motel, and they all know each other, and they're calling each other back and forth, and they've been to, you know, races. All of them have been to Monaco, they've been to Le Mans, and it's all like a big family, and the drivers are kind of outside of it. This would surprise you, you know, most people. The drivers come and go, but the press remains. That's very important to remember. Just like the sporting world everywhere, you know. Pitchers come and go, but Larry Merchant remains. isn't that the truth, you know? Third baseman rise and third baseman fall, but who remains? Lindsey Nelson. And so that's the real world of the race is all these, the journalists who are always writing the critique of the race, and they're writing the brilliant article on Mario Andretti. And around the outskirts, this is something that's kind of interesting. You see the ex-drivers, all kinds of ex-drivers, guys that have, they had their big day, 15, 20 years ago, 10 years ago maybe, and now they're in other businesses. They're working for public relations for somebody, or they're working at an insurance company. And they all drift in, and all these ex-drivers sit around, and they all have a curious kind of sadness around the eyes. Strange thing, because they're no longer part of it. They're kind of left out. It's like half of the journalists, even, they're so hip and with it, they don't even know who these guys are. You know, it's a kind of put down of the ex-driver. And there are three types of drivers, really, basically, now, that are riding in this race. And you'll see them tomorrow. So if you read the the rundown of the drivers, you'll know that there are three general types of drivers. The first type of driver is the professional race driver. This is a guy that started in some little town in North Carolina someplace driving motorcycles when he was 15 during his days in school. He worked his way slowly up through the county fair circuits and the dirt tracks, and finally he was driving the big stocks, you know, and finally, at long last now, he's driving at Indianapolis. This is the professional. This is the hard-bitten type who's out there. He usually has a vaguely bad English, you know. You say, hey, give me one of them round things you're eating over there. What are the things you're eating over there, you know? He's a good old boy type, but these are the hard-eyed professionals who drive and drive to win. They're not involved in any of very few of them are involved in the social life that goes on around it. The second type of driver is the international celebrity type. This is a development in Indianapolis in the past 15 years or so. This is when guys like Jim Clark suddenly showed up and Graham Hill. The elegant drivers of the European circuits began to make it on the Indy tracks. They'd come over here. And that is another very definite, different world. I mean, you're not going to find a Graham Hill having much in common with Cale Yarborough, except they both are men who drive with a heavy foot and fast machines. See, they have that in common, that they're both in a very dangerous, lethal sport. And yet, they're worlds of apart. You'll see Graham Hill, like the time I was at the race last year, Graham Hill had been injured in a race in Europe, and he was not taking part in the Indy. You know, he won it one year, Indianapolis. So Graham Hill, he's elegant. He looks exactly the way you think a British racing car driver should look. He's got this chiseled profile, and he wears this ascot. He's got the elegant club blazer with a great escutcheon, a tremendous coat of arms on his blazer of some obscure racing club in Manchester or Sussex. he really does. He wears the elegant slacks, the gray flannels. And he was sitting on a pile of tires during the race. It was very interesting to watch him down in the pit area. He was just sitting on a pile of tires in somebody's pit. He wasn't involved. He wasn't working with anybody's car. He was just sitting there dressed absolutely with complete English... The way the English can do it, you know, the English are much, how can I say it there? To them, being dressed is a way of life. And here he was elegantly turned out. He was wearing this dark blue blazer and his hair is all kind of being blown by the wind. He looked like he was on the bow of some destroyer in the North Atlantic. On the Murmansk run, you know, that kind of thing. He had this gold pencil mustache, and his eyes were kind of wrinkled around the edges, you know, from squinting into the exhausts of too many cars on the circuits. And he just had that look, you know. And here he is, he's sitting on this pile of tires, and he was talking to no one. And I was maybe two or three feet from him. This is Graham Hill, one of the great names in racing. And nobody's paying any attention. I'm sure the crowd didn't know who he was because he was just sitting there quietly. He wasn't wearing one of the jackets with STP all over it. And he's just watching the cars go by, and he'd sit there, and he never took his eyes off the track. Not once. During the entire three-hour race, he's just sitting there watching. And he'd see them come around that corner, and he's watching very carefully. Car would go whistling by, and he'd watch it as it goes by. What he was thinking, I have no idea. What he was seeing, I have no idea. But he was just watching with absolute concentration. No comment, said nothing. A true pro. Now, that's the second group of drivers, the international celebrity. Now, there's the third group of drivers, which, again, is somewhat of a fairly recent development in America. It's the gentleman scion of the rich family driver who has his old man made a pot of dough in something, see, which the son has nothing to do with, and he's become like, as a matter of fact, there's an old comment in England where they have long experience with the aristocracy. And they say that aristocracy is never the first generation. I mean, the guy that was out there making the dough and winning the title for the family, he was a tough son of a gun who spent his time hitting the Saracens on the head with clubs, you know. It was only, and he finally made the family title and the crest and the coat of arms, and he got the dough together, and it was his son that became the snob. His son had done nothing, see. And so we have that type now beginning to evolve. Dan Gurney is a classic example of that. Peter Revson is probably the most famous example of that type of driver. And Gurney is the gentleman, daredevil, scion of the rich family. You know who Revson is, don't you? Or don't many of you know who Revson is? Well, that's Revlon. He's done very well. That is, his father did very well, and he's been able to indulge his sport of international driving, which is a very expensive sport. And so that's really the basic three groups. Now, there is one other group of driver. This is the fourth group, but it's kind of an interesting group. And the fourth group of driver is the guy who really, in a sense, came up through sport cars and began to develop a reputation in sport cars, then switched to such things as the big stocks at Darlington, and wound up running in the big races. Penske is an example of that. And another one is Yarborough that I mentioned. He's running in the big 500s down at Daytona. And that now here he's racing in Indy. For a long time, you know, these drivers had great disdain. The Indianapolis drivers had great disdain for the guys that drove stocks. Or did you know that? It was just a completely different world. Yeah, I mean, this is ridiculous. On the other hand, you found that the guys in the European circus, they had great disdain for the Indy drivers, except they also had great respect for them because they knew the lethal kind of driving they were involved in and the fantastic amount of human endurance it takes. Now, right now at this minute, now let's pull it up to this second. Right now, I hope this isn't boring you. Well, you know, a lot of people are just not interested in anything other than their own little world, and they don't want to know much about anything else. But the Indianapolis race is a very, very specific American thing. And it is probably the premier sporting event around the world that happens in America. You know, there's much more interest in the Indianapolis race around the world than anything, than say, the Derby, Kentucky Derby. I hate to disabuse you there, but the Kentucky Derby is an American thing. And not many people are interested in the Kentucky Derby in, say, places like Perth, Australia, if they've ever even heard of it. But they do know about Indy. And Indianapolis is like some kind of a phenomena that can't really be described. Another thing, too, I must say about it, is that this particular race, like other great events, I mean, talk about great events that transcend the local interest and so on, cannot really be understood by those who don't really, in a sense, already understand it. Now, what am I saying? It's like what the famous line about jazz, man. If you got to explain it, you'll never know what it's about. It's like humor. If you have to explain a joke to somebody, they're never going to laugh about it. Forget it. And this is really an inexplicable thing, this race. Now, for those of you who don't know anything about how it started, it actually started, you know, to test cars. It started around 1900 and, I think, 1911, something like that. I'm not sure of the date. But the first driver was a man named Haroon, who won it at an average of around 75 miles an hour, which, stopped to think about it, was a lot of... And he was an engineer, incidentally, not a race driver. He was an engineer who had worked on the design of the car, and as an engineer, he went out and he drove this thing as an engineer, and he won it. And that was it. He was not interested at all in the fact that he won the race. He was interested in the machinery. He did his job. And the next year, when they tried to get him to go into this thing, he couldn't understand why they wanted him to come drive it, you know. He was an engineer, and that was it. So Haroon was a very interesting character right from the beginning. And there's been legends that have grown up around the Indianapolis race. There were other famous races back in that time. But none of them have survived the way the Indianapolis has survived. Combination of things. And on the night of the race, this is like tonight, this is the eve of the race, the tension becomes almost unbearable in Gasoline Alley. Now, Gasoline Alley is a long, narrow strip of land that exists right directly behind the main clubhouse, the control tower, the scoreboard, the whole thing that you see once in a while on television. It exists right off the track and is where the cars are kept before they race. There's a whole series of little wooden garages, all one after the other. It's like a little row, one after the other. And on the outside of each one of the garages is the guy's number. You see this big number, 34, 16, 12, 2, 9. And you know immediately whose car you're looking at because of that number. Now, nobody's allowed back in that Gasoline Alley. One of the most difficult passes to get is to be allowed to go back in that area for a lot of reasons. And so, because it's a fairly lethal area. After all, you've got a lot of machinery sitting back there with a lot of very high-octane special fuel that if any minute, if that stuff started to go up, it would be an unbelievable disaster. But here are these 33 cars. That's how many remain after the qualification. In the beginning of the qualification runs, they're usually around 60 to 70, almost sometimes as high as 100 cars that are actually entered in the race. And by the time the qualifications are over, there are just 33 cars. There are 11 rows of three. And that's what the race consists of. Now, they're all parked right now, this minute, as you're listening to me. They're all in those little cubbyhole garages. Now, the garages are tiny by even your standards. A little garage may be only about 6 or 7 feet wide and about 15 feet deep. It's a little flat wooden shed, and the lights are on in every one of those 33 garages. And these guys are crawling over them. And who are they? Well, they're the ace mechanics of each car. There's a head mechanic on each car. There's usually two or three assistant mechanics. Then there's the pit crew. The pit crew is not the mechanics. When people see those guys running around, they generally take photos of the mechanics. No, they're not. That's a pit crew. And these pit crews are as highly trained as any Broadway cast. Man, they can take off four tires. They can completely gas up a car. They can change the plugs. They can do a fantastic operation. They jack up the back. They can even do things like replace wiring, do all this stuff in about 18, 19 seconds. And they move like a wearing blender. If you ever got wound up in the middle of one of those pit crews out there, your level would be screwed right down into a cylinder head, you know? Just, man. Well, that's the pit crew. Now, the pit crew would not be there tonight. See, the pit crew has a very special job. And unless one of the pit crews is also a mechanic, as happens occasionally, they would not be there tonight. Who's there? Well, the mechanics who are working on this car, running tests constantly on it. They're making final jet adjustments, final adjustments for ignition. They're going through everything with a fine tooth. They usually have all the complete shell of the car removed now. And often the car is even completely apart at this hour. It's hard to believe it. And they're working on the thing. Well, what happens outside of the huge oval? Well, of course, Indianapolis, the speedway, is a one-shot thing. That the speedway is used from time to time during the year for various tests. Cars are tested and all that there. But it's one big day is this race. They don't have races at the speedway regularly, you know, which surprises a lot of people. They have one big race a year. So here it is now. There's thousands of people are lined up right now at this minute outside of the gate waiting to get their car into that infield. And they've been waiting in some cases as long as 2 and 3 weeks. And there are old veteran fans. Yes, that's true. Old veteran fans who have jackets on. And they wear these jackets with great pride. It's like campaign ribbons, you know, the guys that fought with Napoleon at Waterloo and all that, you know. And they have patches of all the races that they have been to. And some of these people maintain correspondence with each other throughout the year. They don't see each other except at that race. And the race is the one thing that connects the family, this little family, with another family that, say, lives in Kansas. And they come from all over the country, these fanatics. They come from places, California. They come from up in Canada. And they come from Mexico, every place. And they all gather with their cars waiting outside. They're having parties. They're drinking and everything else. They're walking around talking about family news and stuff, waiting for that 6 o'clock in the morning. There's a cannon goes off. This is part of the tradition. The cannon goes off. The sun is up high now. Boom. And they open the gates, and these cars come roaring in, into the infield. Well, the crowd begins to move in, and by 10 o'clock in the morning, the traffic throughout practically the entire Midwest, certainly throughout all of central Indiana, is affected by this fantastic crowd that's arriving at this race. There's better than 250,000 people, about 300,000 people. Have you ever seen 300,000 people in one collection? It's a fantastic crowd. And the excitement begins to build up. And the thing they're worried about tonight, right now, is that the fear that it may be a very hot day. There are reports that it's going to be hot. Well, that's the worst kind of racing weather, with the possible exception of sleet and rain. Because these cars moving at these fantastic speeds are ovens to begin with. They are just unbelievably hot. You know, one driver's already died in the past 10 years of heat exhaustion. Just died in his car. Did you know about that one? Well, that's how hot these things get. And, of course, if the temperature rises to 100 degrees in the stands, it's about 150 to 200 degrees, almost 200 degrees down on the actual track. And when these cars start roaring with all that horsepower and that curious cooling systems they've got in them, the guy is literally driving an oven around the track with his feet right on the broiler. Right on the broiler. I mean, you could actually broil steaks in the cockpits of some of those cars. So there's a lot of worry about it. And right now, there's parties going on all over Indianapolis. The Elegant Press has arrived. And they're all talking about what happened last year at Monaco and what's going to happen next year at Le Mans. And they're serving, this is a tradition that I never heard of until I became part of that press world. You know that they come into the press room and just after the race starts, they serve a special Indianapolis cheese dip that has been served at the racetrack, apparently, since the beginning of the actual race. And they bring this dip in there. It's not really a dip. It's made out of cream cheese, a curious stuff with fruit in it. And people dip it up with crackers. And it's a very, very traditional thing, only to the press. They bring it in with great fanfare, and they serve this. You see the ex-drivers sort of lurking around the outside talking about their great days when they almost took Wilbur Shaw, the time that they spun out on the south turn just when it looked like they were going to overtake Fred Frame or Tony Bettenhausen. And by the way, that's another group of drivers that's beginning to be very interesting, and that's the second generation Indy drivers, the Bettenhausens. They're at least three drivers whose fathers were great Indianapolis drivers are now driving in tomorrow's race. So the tradition is getting larger and larger, in spite of the fact that in most cases the national press does not pay much attention to that race. Have you noticed that? They don't give it nearly the press, say, that the Kentucky Derby gets. But worldwide, it's another story. Worldwide, the interest in those fast cars, the interest in the drivers. Mario Andretti, for example, is kind of a legend in Italy now. The great American driver who won the race a couple of years ago. And the Unsers are strange, taciturn, enigmatic guys that are heroes of their home state. Where are they from? All right, these are hard-driving Westerners. They had the look in the eye, Bobby and Al. of the professional driver. And at 12 noon, the balloons will go up, and ooh, they'll roar off. This is WOR New York. You stay tuned for Lester Smith and the News.